Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 30th of April, these are our main stories. Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will carry out an operation in Rafah, regardless of whether a ceasefire deal is reached with Hamas in Gaza. And a senior commander of the Islamic State group in Africa, who had a $5 million US bounty on his head, is reported to have been killed. Also in this podcast, a leaked document obtained by the BBC says a teenager who vanished during anti-government protests in Iran was sexually assaulted and killed by men working for the security forces.
She was last seen running from the authorities. For 9 days, her mother searched for her. Then she was called to identify her body. Nika had massive head injuries.
And in The Gambia, a study has found that a stick-on measles vaccine patch could be an effective alternative to injections. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel will carry out an offensive against Hamas in Rafah, regardless of whether or not a ceasefire and hostage release deal is reached. In a statement from his office, he added that stopping the war before achieving the goal of defeating Hamas was out of the question. Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Mr. Netanyahu's comments appear to align him with far-right ministers who want to prioritise an offensive in Rafah. He reiterated that Israel would eliminate Hamas battalions in the southern city to achieve total victory. Benny Gantz, a centrist minister who's in the war cabinet, has argued that the government must not block a responsible hostage deal if it can be reached without ending the war. The US says that extremely generous terms have been offered to Hamas for a new ceasefire, expected to last for 6 weeks, in return for freeing Israeli hostages.
In other developments in the Middle East, the head of the United Nations Aid Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, has welcomed the restoration of funding by some donor countries and urged others to follow suit. But Philippe Lazzarini also raised concern over the way Israel treats detainees.
People have told us that they are routinely rounded up. When they were arrested, they were routinely rounded up, stripped to their underwear and loaded into trucks, blindfolded and bound. Most of the time, once arrested, these detainees remain incommunicado and they are subjected to shocking inhuman treatment. Among the inhuman treatment, they have described to us waterboarding, severe beatings, attacked by dogs, being forced to hold stress position for hours, sometimes 12 hours, 24 hours, and being forced to wear diaper instead of accessing the toilet. And among the detainees who have been relieved, we had also a number of UNRWA staff, and they have also reported to us that while under interrogation they were asked a lot of questions about their work with UNRWA, and basically also being pressured to state the agency is politically affiliated in the Gaza Strip.
Our correspondent in Switzerland, Imogen Folks, told us more about what he had to say.
He talked about the real fear in Rafah, where over a million Gazans have gone to, hoping it will be safe, that there could be an Israeli attack there almost imminent. You know, the Israeli government has said they do need to go into Rafah. He said in northern Gaza, where UNRWA itself has not been able to deliver food since January, there is, its staff in the north report, there is some more food available in the markets. It's still a race against time to avert famine. He said, offer that as a bit of good news. And he seemed very pleased that he has managed to persuade countries to restore funding that they suspended to UNRWA, Germany, for example, and he has new funding from other countries and private funding. So the financial security of the agency, Mr. Lazzarini thinks, is secure at least for the next couple of months.
And how far was what he had to say an attempt to further restore UNRWA's good name? Because it has obviously received quite a lot of criticism.
Absolutely. I mean, clearly, that's what he wants to do. He is head of this organisation. I would add that here in Geneva, the humanitarian agencies speak with one voice that UNRWA can't be replaced in the middle of a humanitarian crisis. It's the key agency on the ground. But there is this UNRWA investigation into those 19 UNRWA staff that Israel says took part in the October 7th attacks. That is ongoing. Most of them remain suspended. One has been cleared, Mr. Lazzarini told us today. But clearly, this is a damage limitation exercise with, from UNRWA's point of view, a bit of good news that they are getting some funding restored.
Imogen Folks. In Mali, the authorities say a commander of a West African affiliate of the Islamic State group, Abu Huzaifa, has been killed. Here's the announcement on State TV.
The Malian army has succeeded where armies said to be the most powerful in the world have failed. Abu Huzaifa, known as Higo, a foreign terrorist leader and internationally famous and who plagued the Sahel, has been neutralized.
Abu Huzaifa, who had a $5 million US bounty on his head, was killed during a large-scale operation involving forces from several countries. Over the past decade, attacks by groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have killed thousands of people in the region, and in the last 12 months, IS has expanded significantly in areas in northern Mali. Our Africa regional editor is Will Ross.
Abu Huzaifa was, we believe, responsible for quite a lot of the attacks, recent attacks in the Menaka region in northeast Mali. He was also known as Higo, and photos of him made him pretty distinctive with a very long beard. And he was one of several commanders linked to the Islamic State group whom the American authorities have put a bounty on the head of because of a 2017 attack. People might remember an ambush in which four American and at least four Nigerian soldiers were killed in a place called Tongo Tongo. That was an ambush. Since then, French officials had announced that one of the other leaders had been killed in an airstrike. But as we heard in that clip earlier, the Malian authorities really kind of bragging a bit and saying powerful forces, what they were referring to was, you know, the Americans were here, the French were here, they couldn't kill him, but we've managed to kill him. And we understand this was a joint operation.
Yes, it was. As far as we understand, it was an international operation. There were several countries involved. Tell us about the operation to bring him down.
Well, what the State TV in Mali says is this was an operation involving troops from Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger. Now, these three countries are all under military rule. They've all basically been distancing themselves from former colonial power France that was very active militarily in the region, and French troops have been booted out. But there have also been ties cut with the United States. So the fact that these three armies are working together and saying that they've had some success against the Islamist militants is significant. We don't obviously have total proof of exactly what happened, but these three countries, the military rulers there, are under a lot of pressure because the reason they seized power, they said, was because the elected governments had failed to make any progress stopping the Islamist militant attacks. So it's all about insecurity. And can these three countries that are now pretty close to Russia instead of United States and other Western countries, can they make a difference in stopping the attacks and trying to protect communities? Because large areas of Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger are often targeted by these Islamist militants.
That was Will Ross. A teenager found dead during Iran's high-profile anti-government protests was sexually assaulted and killed by undercover agents working for Iran's security forces, according to a leaked document obtained by a BBC World Service investigation. Nika Shakarami was 16 when she disappeared in September 2022 after telling a friend that police were chasing her. Her family found her body 9 days later. The authorities denied any involvement in her death, claiming that she took her own life. Reha Kansara has this report from BBC Eye Investigations. And a warning, some listeners might find this distressing.
It's September 2022, and Iran is engulfed by the flames of protest. The spark is the death in custody of a 22-year-old woman detained for violating strict rules requiring females to cover their hair in public. Her name, Mahsa Amini, and her death ignites a movement which spreads via social media. In Tehran, just days after Mahsa Amini's death, a 16-year-old girl rises from a large demonstration. She climbs a dumpster, and to the cheers of the crowd, she holds up her burning headscarf. She is Nika Shakarami. Millions have since seen videos of her singing to friends and striking images of the teenager in bold lipstick and dark eyeliner on social media. Back at the protest, she commands attention. Undercover agents were watching her too, according to what appears to be a classified report from inside Iran's security machine, obtained by the BBC. And like Mahsa Amini, we've found she would soon be arrested and die in custody. She was last seen running from the authorities. For 9 days, her mother searched for her. Then she was called to identify her body. Nika had massive head injuries. Now, through the leaked report obtained by BBC Eye Investigations, we're able to piece together what happened to Nika. Michael Simpkin is a producer with BBC Eye Investigations.
It's never been published before and was drawn up by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, an elite section of Iran's security service. It appears to be a summary of a classified hearing into what happened to the teenager Nika. It includes names and testimony of those who were with her when she was killed.
This is some of what it says. The undercover agents at the protest suspect Nika of being an organizer. The order is given to arrest her. She is held in the back of an unmarked freezer truck with three members of that team, referred to as Team 12. Here is some of what they said, spoken by actors. And a warning, they describe a killing.
I don't know what happened, but after a few minutes, she started swearing. I couldn't see anything. I could only hear fighting and bashing.
I turned on my phone light and saw Sadiq was sitting on her, with his hands in her pants.
I never put my hand in her pants, but I can't deny that when I was sitting on her, I got aroused and touched her buttocks. She kicked at my face, so I had to defend myself.
From the front of the vehicle, the leader of Team 12 hears the attack and stops the van. When the rear doors are opened, he finds Nika's lifeless body. A senior commander is called to report the incident. He tells them to dump the body on the street. The report concluded that sexual assault caused the fight in the rear compartment. It's difficult to authenticate leaks with many fake Iranian documents in circulation. But we've spent months cross-checking it with multiple sources, including a former Iranian intelligence officer who has seen hundreds of documents like this one.
Is there any way that document could be a fake?
No, it's nothing. It's original and we accept that. It's not fake.
While we can't confirm every detail, overall, we believe it's genuine. As far as we can tell, the men responsible for Nika's death have never been punished. Our investigation has found their commanding officer received a written reprimand for ordering Nika's body to be dumped on the street, but has since been promoted. We put our allegations to members of Team 12, the IRGC and the Iranian government. They did not respond.
You can watch the full investigation, Nika's Last Breath, on the BBC World Service YouTube page. Measles is highly contagious and can kill. Since the COVID pandemic, the number of children across the world who are being vaccinated against the disease has been falling. But could a small patch offer a cheaper and easier alternative to measles injections? It's been trialled in West Africa, in the Gambia. Our health reporter Michelle Roberts told us more about the patch.
when you look at it under the microscope, it's got these tiny, tiny little microarray needles, they call it. But it's not like your conventional needle that you jab in the arm that we have other vaccines with. This one is getting around that. So it does look like a sticking plaster that you just put on. In the trial, they've left it for about 5 minutes on the skin. So it's not meant to cause any discomfort or pain. So it really is a sticking plaster that can deliver these important vaccines.
And obviously that's a huge advantage over injections. You don't need needles or syringes or medical staff.
Yeah, I mean, this is really important for places where it's hard to physically get the vaccines out to the people. So, you know, you can see how if you don't need all of the refrigeration, all of the glass little vials, all of the things that can be quite problematic, and also the needles themselves. You know, you can get a needle stick injury rarely. If you're trying to give a vaccine to somebody, you need to be quite trained. Whereas with the sticking plaster, you can see how more people would be able to administer it, and it would just be easier to get out around the world.
So just how big a trial is this?
So they looked at around 240 young children and toddlers and a handful of adults as well, just to see if it was doing what they were hoping it was, and it was.
That being the case, when might it be possible to roll it out more broadly?
So they'll want to do a few more trials still, but they really are hopeful that they can get this going. It's got some funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine have been working on it with them, UNICEF. There's also the hope that you could do other diseases too. So you could do things like flu, HPV and also rabies. So it's got a lot of potential.
Measles is an incredibly contagious and dangerous illness. Why have rates of child vaccination been falling?
Obviously, we had the COVID pandemic, and that had a real knock-on effect in getting all the other important vaccines out there to people. And we have seen around the world a drop-off, sadly, in the number of young children that have been protected against measles, mumps, rubella, some of these really nasty childhood infections. And it's very concerning. I mean, measles is so contagious. So if you have people who are unvaccinated, 9 in 10 will catch it if they're exposed to it. It really is very, very contagious, and it can be extremely serious and deadly. So it really is important to get those vaccination rates up.
That was Michelle Roberts. When Dublin hosted the Eurovision Song Contest 30 years ago this week, an unknown Irish dancer from Chicago was asked to perform as the interval act. Ireland won Eurovision that year for the second year in a row. The country was on a winning streak. But it was the interval act that stole the show. Michael Flatley's performance with Riverdance dragged this centuries-old traditional form of dance into the modern age and to a whole new audience, and it launched a multi-million dollar show that has travelled the world ever since. The BBC's culture reporter Charlotte Gallagher went to Dublin to meet him.
Ladies and gentlemen, Riverdance. Eurovision 1994 in Dublin. This was the interval act.
There was just something in the air that night. I could feel it. There's no way to explain it. It was just so real. And I was wound up like a slingshot, ready to go.
And now Earthrise, Michael Flatley, showing his mastery of the hard shoe tap.
30 years ago, you changed Irish dance. What are your memories of that evening?
My goodness, that brings up a lot of memories. It was very, very special. I had been working my whole life to change Irish dance, and I didn't have the platform that I was dreaming of. There was a lot of apprehension about somebody coming in and changing the form of dance in Ireland. And in fact, right before I went on stage, they came to me and said, please, we're getting calls from all the dance teachers. Please don't wave your arms around. You're going to make us look ridiculous in front of the world, and we'll be very embarrassed. So can we just ask you this time, whatever happens, keep your arms down. And I said no.
And a lot of people watching Eurovision would have never seen Irish dancing before, because there was people right across Europe, across the world.
Yes.
So it was that chance to show it to the world and show what you can do.
How cool is that? We nailed it. My dream, for 35 years, I was working in construction sites and digging foundations in Chicago in those freezing cold winters, but I was creating those steps in my dance style in my mind that whole time. That's what got me through the hard labor, was that, bring this dance form to the world. Some of our stars are from Hungary and Holland and from Asia. It's fabulous.
Being a young boy growing up in Chicago and wanting to dance wasn't easy for Michael.
I got bullied at school terribly, so I know what young lads go through, and it's trying. It's mentally difficult. It's stressful to have to walk into school and hope somebody doesn't say something negative toward you. But if you look at our dancers now, men are so powerfully masculine, and they're just so buffed, cut, ripped. Their diet and their training regimes, everything is specific and perfect. They've taken it to a whole new level. Our guys, they're treated like rock stars when they come off the stage. You would not believe the amount of people swarming around them for photos and signatures, and that's my dream.
Irish dancing has now spread across the world, with schools in China, South America, Africa, and right across Europe.
And did you ever think, 30 years later, you'd be talking still about that moment?
To be honest with you, I'm delighted I'm even here 30 years later. At the pace I was going, I never thought I would be. So, yes, it was always my dream. I visualized it, and I made it, and I'm here.
Good grief. That brought the folk memories out. Small hairs rising in the back of every Irishman's neck. Bill Whelan, sensational river dance.
The voice of Terry Wogan, ending that report by Charlotte Gallagher. Still to come in this podcast.
He wasn't sure democracy was all that it was cracked up to be. He thought the world would be a much better place if it was run by philosophers.
We've a fascinating insight into the final hours of the philosopher Plato. Zimbabweans can use their new currency today. It's called ZiG, which stands for Zimbabwe Gold, and is backed by the precious metal. It's the latest attempt to stabilise Zimbabwe's volatile economy, which has lurched from crisis to crisis and hyperinflation over the past few decades. The ZiG replaces the Zimbabwean dollar, which lost 80% of its value against the US currency this year. Our correspondent in Zimbabwe, Shingar Nyoka, told us more.
From early this morning, there were a few people outside various banks and ATMs waiting to withdraw the cash. The digital version of the ZiG has been in circulation since early April, when it was officially introduced. And so, yes, people are transacting with the new currency, but it must be said that the US dollar, which is also legal tender here, accounts for about 80% of transactions. And so most people tend to prefer to use the US dollar. Businesses prefer to accept the US dollar rather than the local currency because it's, you know, it's easier to plan ahead and it's more stable. So yes, it's in use, but I'm just not sure if people actually want this currency.
Which do you think is going to prevail?
The Zimbabwe dollar was scrapped in early April, and it's been replaced by the ZiG. That was because it had lost a significant value since it was reintroduced in 2019. And so the ZiG is the sixth currency, the sixth attempt by the government to try to create a local, stable, domestic currency. But Zimbabweans have already made that decision. They prefer to use the US dollar. And so the central bank has admitted that it needs to try to rebuild trust in the local currency. That's why it's backed this currency by gold.
Shingar Nyoka in Zimbabwe. In Haiti, a new transitional presidential council is choosing the country's new president. It's hoped it will bring the nation under control amid escalating gang violence. The new government's mandate is supposed to run until February 2026, by which time elections should be held. Victoria Ouwonghunda spoke to former Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive, and she started by asking him what he made of the new transitional council and what led to its inception.
There was a total institutional vacuum in Haiti. A president assassinated and never replaced. A prime minister kept in exile. a government only virtually managing current affairs, a parliament obsolete for years. Even at the level of local authorities, there were no elected official anymore. So there is a need to rebuild legitimacy to address the real challenge facing the Haitian people. Personally, I would have preferred something simpler, more in line with the spirit of the Constitution and less under the influence of political forces, which are ultimately involved in the current crisis. For me, it's like wanting to put a Ferrari engine to drive a tractor. But that being said, the debates must stop and decisions must be made to follow, to allow hope to be reborn within a population that no longer knows where to turn. The international community sees the Presidential Council as a necessary step to give birth to a government with at least some legitimacy.
When you say you would have preferred something simpler, what do you mean?
Is we had several transitions in Haiti, and in general, we go to a way to install a president, either through the High Court or by election by the Senate, but we don't have Senate right now. One person representing the presidency would have been a better solution.
We've been hearing from gang leaders who say that the political class of which you used to be part of have let down the people of Haiti. You yourself were designated by the U.S. State Department for participating in corrupt activities. Mm-hmm. How can the political class in Haiti regain the trust of the people?
I don't want to have a specific defense of my case in that short interview. But everything is explained by corruption. Corruption doesn't justify what I see in Haiti today. I've traveled a lot in different countries. There is corruption everywhere, perhaps not at the level of Haiti. But for me, it's not a good enough explanation. There is corruption. We have to fight it. But just to explain the situation of Haiti today, saying they are all corrupt, for me, is a shortcut that is not going to solve the problems of Haiti.
Are you hopeful that come February 2026, there will be a democratically elected government in Haiti?
We cannot continue to go down into hell as we are right now in Haiti. We have to find a way to work together. We have to have election. Before that, we have to change the constitution. It's my point of view. We have a too complex constitution that is not ready to resolve our actual problem. So, yes, I'm hopeful. It can be done. It's possible if we work together.
Former Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive. The collapse of a dam in Brazil in 2015 unleashed millions of cubic meters of toxic mining waste sludge, burying villages and killing 19 people. It was one of Brazil's worst environmental catastrophes. But 9 years on, the hundreds of thousands of mainly indigenous victims are still waiting for compensation. The mine was owned jointly by Brazil's Vale Company and the Anglo-Australian mining firm BHP. In January, a Brazilian court ordered them to pay compensation for the damage caused, and now both companies have agreed to pay $25 billion. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, told us more about how this environmental disaster unfolded.
Well, that happened at the end of 2015 when this dam used by the mining companies to store waste, toxic waste from iron ore mining, just collapsed on top of communities and the river, and the destruction caused was huge. 19 people died, could have been many, many more. But then what happened is this toxic waste using this, it's called the tailings dam, went down the river, an important river in the state of Minas Gerais, and all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, at least 500 kilometers away east, causing huge damage. Hundreds of thousands of people were affected somehow by it, by this disaster, and many were directly affected. They lost their land, they lost everything that they had. To make matters worse, a few years later, a similar accident happened in the same area, killing many more people.
And it was mainly indigenous communities that were affected. What are the victims looking for? And is this offer from the companies likely to satisfy them?
What these communities say is that their way of life has been destroyed, has been ruined, and is not coming back. What the government has been negotiating, the Brazilian government was very forceful at the time, is a big settlement where they would try to restate the fauna, the flora there, basically try to get people to where they were before and to give them financial compensation. But there are many lawsuits in court in different parts of the world against those companies because they are international companies. The perception in Brazil and the perception from campaigners is that people have been abandoned, that very little has been done, and that it's too little too late for these people. The Brazilian government, they say they will reach a deal by the middle of the year. What the companies say is that they did their best, and that's a risk that everyone was willing to pay because it's a very profitable industry, and when something like that happens, they know they have to pay.
Leonardo Rocha was speaking to Janat Jalil. Here in Britain, King Charles has carried out his first public event since his cancer diagnosis. Accompanied by Queen Camilla, he visited a cancer centre at a London hospital where he met patients and medical staff. This report from our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
The King looked happy to be out and about in this, his first public engagement since his cancer was announced 12 weeks ago. At University College Hospital in central London, he stepped out into sunshine and then into the hospital as he toured a cancer treatment centre with the Queen. Cheers greeted him as he went inside. There he met staff and patients hearing about new treatments and from those like him receiving treatment. Asked how he was, he said, "I'm all right, thank you."
Johnny Diamond. Now, it was widely reported last week that an Italian researcher had identified the location of the burial place in Athens of the ancient Greek philosopher Plato after examining papyrus rolls found in the Roman town of Herculaneum. Well, now a fascinating nugget has emerged from the papyrus of how Plato apparently spent his last moments. Paul Moss told us more.
There were philosophers before Plato, but he's the man who really lays out the agenda, the scope of the subject, and also the sort of logical approach which others followed. I should say Plato was a pupil of Socrates, and much of what we get from Plato is really just Socrates speaking. The older man would just wander around Athens, pestering passers-by, winding them up with philosophical conundrums. Plato was the man who did the hard graft of actually writing it down. He had two big interests, metaphysics, questions like, what do we know about reality? How can we be sure what appears to us is really there? Plato was also very interested in politics. He wasn't sure democracy was all that it was cracked up to be. He thought the world would be a much better place if it was run by philosophers.
Now, so how exactly have we learnt more about the man who lived 2,500 years ago?
Well, this really is incredible. When Mount Vesuvius, the volcano, blew its top in AD 79, it destroyed the nearby towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum. One of the villas in Herculaneum was owned by a man who seems to have been a bit of an intellectual. The house was full of scrolls, a bit like nowadays when you go to someone's house and they're showing off by having all sorts of clever books on the shelf. He was similar. Tragically, though, the scrolls, like everything else, was burned to a cinder when Vesuvius erupted. Incredibly, as you were suggesting before, scientists in Italy at the University of Pisa, they found a way to read the scrolls using infrared light. Apparently, there is a tiny difference in the way infrared light is reflected on burned papyrus if it once had ink on it. It really is as if you chucked a newspaper on a fire and found that you could still read it afterwards. And amongst these ancient scrolls was a description about Plato's life.
OK, so that's the how. What have we learnt?
Well, so far, for what they've deciphered, as you suggested, what we've really learned is how his life ended. Now, I should say why this has particular fascination was because his teacher, Socrates, his death is regarded as one of the great moments of ancient history. He paced around, he'd been sentenced to drink poisonous hemlock, and right to the end, he reflected on life, death, the truths of life. So people hope for something similar with Plato, but it turns out it was a bit different. For his last moments, what we learned is that he invited a friend round and they hired a slave girl to dance and play the flute for them. And as he was gasping his final breaths, Plato, we're told, looked up and complained that she didn't actually have a very good sense of rhythm.
So after a life of great profound reflection, a death coming after someone having a bit of a whinge.
That was our philosophy correspondent, Paul Moss. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Ed Horton. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.